Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, and welcome everyone to New Books in the Indian Ocean World, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Irene Pramod, a host on this channel, and today I'll be in conversation with Dr. Miriam Luking, author of the incredible new book, Indonesians and Their Arab World, Guided Mobility Among Labor Migrants and Mecca Pilgrims, which was published by Cornell University Press in January 2021. Miriam Luking is a social anthropologist and postdoctoral fellow at the Martin Buber Society of Fellows at the Hebrew University of Jerusalem. Her doctoral research, which she completed in 2017 at the University of Freiburg, Germany, focused on the experiences of Indonesian labor migrants and Mecca pilgrims circulating in the Indian Ocean world. Miriam's publications speak to a number of issues regarding pilgrimage, Islamic morality, gendered mobility, transnational identity formation, and saint veneration. In addition to her recently published book, her work has also appeared in journals such as Transregional and National Studies of Southeast Asia, Social Sciences, and Food, Culture, and Society. Thank you, Miriam, for agreeing to join me here on the New Books Network. I thoroughly enjoyed reading your book, and I'm really excited to delve into it with you today.
Yeah, thank you very much for inviting me and for giving me the opportunity to talk about the book.
It's my pleasure. It might be good to perhaps start off with a brief sort of bio introduction to you as the author. So could you tell us a few words about your own personal background and what led you to become an anthropologist?
Yeah, so I grew up in a small village in northern Germany. And I didn't know anything about Islam, the Arab world, or Indonesia. But after high school, I wanted to do a gap year, and I was looking for organizations. I had an interest in Asia, and I ended up on Nias Island, which is a small island off the west coast of North Sumatra, which back then was badly affected by the Indian Ocean tsunami in 2004. And it was on Nias that I got to know about anthropology. I met anthropologists there. And also in this tsunami rehabilitation and reconstruction work, I understood how important it is to have local specific knowledge of how a society works, what is important for people. You cannot just build new houses if these houses do not accommodate the needs of the people. So that's how I came to anthropology. I also traveled. During that time, I spent a year in Indonesia, and I visited Jawa, where I met more Muslim people, because Nias is a Christian island. And then I felt that there are worlds between Nias and Java, even, not to speak of the worlds between my own small German town and Indonesia, and the whole realization of how limited our horizon is got me interested in anthropology. And specifically, I visited Gajah Mada University in Yogyakarta. And I went to the Department of Anthropology, and the people there told me, you have to go and study at the University of Freiburg if you are from Germany, because we have a collaboration with Freiburg. And it turned out that anthropologists from the University of Freiburg invite anthropologists from Indonesia, from Gajah Mada University, to do research in Germany. And I found that fascinating, that there are Indonesian anthropologists who do research on our society, on the German society. And I was very curious in getting to know what are their perspectives. And I did go to study in Freiburg, anthropology and Islamic studies. And I did participate in these exchanges with Gajah Mada University, where I learned a lot from these reciprocal exchanges of perspectives. And in Islamic studies, I got to know a little bit about the Arab world. I started to study Arabic. I went myself to visit some Arab countries. I was in Syria and Morocco. And all of this led me a bit to this topic of Indonesia and the Arab world.
Yeah, it's fascinating because it's also incredible to kind of see how much of fieldwork is often a combination of various accidental discoveries and encounters. So yeah, that's fascinating. And could you also tell us a bit about how you came to write this book, Indonesians in the Arab World? For instance, how did the idea develop, and why did the question of religious and transnational mobility in particular interest you?
Yeah, when I was based in Freiburg, I visited Indonesia a lot for various projects. And I think it was a time over about 10 years that I was going back and forth between Indonesia and Germany. And I was very interested in Islamic cultures in Indonesia. As I said before, I didn't know a lot about Islam before I traveled to Indonesia. And when I began to study Islamic studies at the University of Freiburg and also in Syria and Morocco, I realized that when I came back to Indonesia with my knowledge in Islamic studies and also Arabic language in particular, I found a new connection with people in Indonesia. A lot of people in Indonesia were excited that I spoke Arabic, and they saw it as a uniting element, that we can chit-chat a bit in Arabic, or that I could even read in the Quranic or schools the traditional pesantren in Indonesia. People would sometimes also write the local Javanese language and Arabic script. And it was interesting that I was able to read the script. So there were new points of encounter because of my knowledge of Arabic. And back then I was based in Freiburg in a Southeast Asian studies network called Grounding Area Studies and Social Practice. And my supervisor, Judith Schlehe, did research on perceptions and images of the West in Indonesia. And then we thought it would be interesting to look also at other centers and reference points among Indonesians, where the West is maybe an important reference point for modernity. The Arab world is important for Muslim identities. And because of my own knowledge that I had about Islamic studies and Arabic, it seemed very fitting that I would work on that topic. And it felt like a good entry point that I had this connection to people. And also over the years, I realized that what I found was a fascinating connection, and maybe gave me a little bit of an idea of how people can feel connected in the faith of Islam as Muslim brothers and sisters. I found that on the other hand, there was also a lot of skepticism about so-called Arabness, or as people in Indonesia would say, Arab, that they would describe someone as being Arab or being Arab-minded. And I found that in these cases, the term Arab was used in a denouncing manner, or also that there is the buzzword Arabisasi in Indonesia, the Arabization that is used in a denouncing manner of describing other people as, as turning out a change of Islamic traditions in Indonesia. So this is a development that I observed over the years of visiting Indonesia. And then I thought it's interesting to look into this and to research this.
Absolutely. And also something that runs throughout your book, I found, was a sort of transnational imaginary of the Arab world in the local world of the people of Indonesia themselves. And so this interplay between the transnational and the local is something that I found to be very, very interesting in the context of your own book. But before we dive straight into the book, I'd like to also ask if you could briefly take us through the historical context of this book and its findings. For instance, how do we understand the contemporary labor migration flows from Indonesia to the Persian Gulf vis-a-vis longer histories of mobility and the spread of Islam in the Indian Ocean world? And this is something that you touch on very, very much in your book. But it'd be great, I think, for our audience if you could also sort of present the historical context that your book is sort of grounded in.
Yeah, sure. Something that I didn't say or that I maybe will also talk about a bit more later is that how I came to this idea to compare labor migrants and Mecca pilgrims. But I'll probably say more about that later. About the historical background, the Hajj, the pilgrimage to Mecca, is one of the five pillars of Islam, and it's obligatory for Muslim people, for people who can physically and financially and spiritually afford to do this pilgrimage to the holy sites in Mecca and Medina. And of course, it's for people, for Muslim people all over the world, it's a lifelong goal. It's something that many people save up to and that they want to accomplish. Now, when we go back in history, Indonesia being located far away from the Arabian Peninsula, divided through the Indian Ocean, of course, given this geographic location, for many people in Indonesia, it was difficult to do the Hajj to Mecca and Medina. And in the 15th century, when pilgrimages from Indonesia to the Arabian Peninsula started, this voyage was a more individual endeavor, and it was more reserved to people who could afford this costly undertaking. Later, it was also connected to study journeys and to trade and to economic activities. So we can really speak of a mixed migration historically, that studying, working, and doing the Hajj was something that went together, and where people would stay for much longer time periods in the Hijaz, study with sheikhs there, and they had communities of so-called Jawi people, of people from the island of Jawa. That's something Michael Lafon worked on a lot. So this was, again, it was something that happened in scholarly communities, mostly men traveling there and staying for many years on the Arabian Peninsula. And when they came back, they would often be community leaders in society. That's the actual physical journeys to the Arabian mm-hmm. Peninsula, but there is also in Indonesia a lot of historical stories about mystical journeys, people who probably could not travel there physically, but who traveled there in meditation, in dream journeys. There is the legend of Sultan Agung, famous leader on the island of Java, who traveled to Mecca in a dream journey and who took a lump of earth from Mecca and placed it on his future gravesite in Imogiri, thus creating a Mecca or a holy place in Java. And these dream journeys or these more mystical and spiritual connections are also important for the people who came from the Arabian Peninsula, traders, but also Muslim scholars who spread Islam in Indonesia. So that's the historical connections through trade, economic activities, Islamic scholarship, and pilgrimage. In Dutch colonial times, the travels to the Arabian Peninsula from Southeast Asia became much more structured and regulated, also with the invention of the steamship. And it's interesting that the Dutch were actually the first non-Muslim country to have a travel office in Jeddah. So this is also where we see that with the pilgrimage, there is also business, and more people were able to make this journey. Today, the pilgrimage to Mecca and Medina is a highly structured and vastly organized mass event where millions, I mean, if it's not the COVID pandemic, millions of people come to Mecca every year on the designated dates for the Hajj. And the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia regulates the numbers of pilgrims through pilgrimage quotas. So Indonesia, as being home to the largest Muslim population in the world, is allocated a relatively high quota in total numbers. So they make the biggest, the largest national group of pilgrims every year in Mecca. And this, of course, demands a master plan of organization. And there are 10 charter flights each day over a period of a month to bring all people to Mecca to be there on the designated dates for the Hajj. And the Ministry of Religion and all the sub-departments handle this. So it's also a big bureaucratic and organizational effort. And it's quite interesting that for labor migration, there are similar structures when it comes to the organization or even the flights or even the airport, the Hajj terminal in Jakarta is outside the Hajj season, is being used for labor migrants. And for labor migrants, it's, of course, different government departments. But we see that for both labor migration and pilgrimage, the Indonesian government is a very important actor in making this mobility happen, in organizing and facilitating it, in, as I say in the book, guiding people's mobility. So, yeah, in the 21st century, both labor migration and mobility are highly structured journeys. And for the pilgrimage, this would mostly happen in guided travel groups. And labor migrants are being recruited through migrant agencies, and they are also coming together in cohorts where they are prepared together in preparation centers. But then, of course, they would later on have a more individual experience, as most of the Indonesians work as private domestic workers in private households in the Gulf. So there are differences and similarities. And in some cases, there is also a mixture between labor migration and pilgrimage.
Yeah, absolutely. And this term guided mobility, I personally found it very productive to think with, and we'll come back to it in the following, in one of the next questions. But in terms of method, I really appreciated and admired how you moved across three planes of comparison throughout the book between the urban and the rural within Indonesia, between the coastal and inland regions of the region of Indonesia, and migrants and pilgrims to Mecca in Saudi Arabia, as you sort of just laid out now as well, and the distinctions between both groups. And I wanted to ask, what did you hope this three-way comparison would help you achieve in the book?
Yeah, so in the beginning, I did not actually plan to do a comparison. My research approach was very open-minded. It was this idea of having an inductive approach, or at least semi-inductive approach, of going to the field and to understand what is important to the people. So as I said, there was this research project on images of the West in Indonesia. So I went to Indonesia and I had this idea of working on images of the Arab world. And I had different ideas of where to look for this in Quranic schools, in Islamic universities. I thought more of education in the beginning. But then it was this Hajj season, and I realized that this is the biggest movement, the biggest event of mobility that happens annually in Indonesia. And also during my own travels to Indonesia with layovers in Dubai and Abu Dhabi, I realized that, wow, labor migrants and Mecca pilgrims actually sometimes sit next to each other on the plane. But then the two fields, labor migration and pilgrimage, seem to be so different. Pilgrimage is a spiritual experience. It's also a source of social status or social prestige in Indonesia, whereas labor migration is something that happens for people who search for higher or better income, who maybe do not have perspectives back in their home in Indonesia, and they are willing to go abroad to search for higher incomes. So in a way, labor migration and Mecca pilgrimage present two contrasts in these ambivalent Indonesian engagements with the Arab world, where for the Mecca pilgrimage, the Arab world is, of course, the Holy Land, and it's this lifelong goal of going to Mecca, and it's home to the holy sites. Whereas in the context of labor migration, there is actually often a rather negative image of the Arab world being drawn in Indonesian public, in the media coverage, where we can read a lot about exploitation and abuse of migrant women, and in protests of human rights NGOs or labor migrant NGOs, there would actually often be this demonization of Arab countries, or the idea that there is evil and exploitation there, and human rights abuse. So I thought it's interesting to look at these two contrasting experiences with the Arab world, even though later I also realized that they are not always so contrasting. That's maybe only the first impression. And then also during my research, it was very interesting that when I started my research in Central Java, and I said, what I'm interested in is how people look at the Arab world, a lot of Javanese people said, oh, you should go to Mecca Island. You should go to Madura. So that was they said, you should go to Madura Island. And that I said Mecca now is maybe also because people say sometimes Madura is one of the islands of one of the terraces. It's one of the terraces of Mecca in Indonesia. Also, Aceh is described as a terrace of Mecca. And those are by names for more conservative areas in Indonesia. But also, as we see, often by names for regions that are more coastal and that have this historical coastal connection to the Arab world. And a lot of people said, go to Madura, because Madura is the people in Madura, they are like the Arabs. And then I realized that this term Arab in among Indonesians can also be a term that is used to describe people in one's own country. And I was very, very curious about this. And then I did go to Madura, and I came up with this comparison also between Central Java and Madura, to understand that to think about the Arab world is, on the one hand, to think about transnational mobility and transnational or transregional connections between Southeast Asia and the Arabian Peninsula, but on the other hand, it's also the Arab world in Indonesia, and how this term or this idea of something Arab is imagined within Indonesia.
Absolutely. And there are these competing but also not competing ideas of Arabness within Indonesia itself that sort of came out and sort of popped up from the book time and time again. And we will get into this in more detail as well. But perhaps since your book is sort of divided into these four main chapters, perhaps it might be productive to sort of go through each of the chapters, starting with the first one. And so if I had to do that, so the first chapter of your book, it traces the making of a transnational Arab imaginary, as you just told us, in Indonesian Islam and the Arabization of Indonesian society itself. And I was intrigued by how local Indonesians grappled with what it meant to be Muslim alongside what it meant to be Arab, vis-a-vis the authentic Arabness of the Middle East. And so I wanted to ask, how do Indonesians straddle these multiple Islams and multiple ideas of Arabness, even as they travel to and from the Arab world itself?
Yeah, so the first chapter draws a lot on the historical, the work of historians like Michael Lafan, Eric Tagliacozzo, Mona Abaza, Chiara Formici, who all have shown that the Indonesian engagement with the Arab world is really multifarious. And the Arab world is also an imaginatory construct in Indonesia, where I mentioned the Muslim saints before, the Muslim saints who brought Islam to Jawa. It is assumed that these Muslim saints have a diverse cultural and ethnic background, and some of them came probably from the Arabian Peninsula, probably from Persia and China. But then in everyday rhetoric in Indonesia, they are still often referred to as Arab saints. And the interesting thing is that on the one hand, it is acknowledged that they came from outside Indonesia and probably from somewhere close to the birthplace of Islam. But on the other hand, they also localized Islam in Indonesia, and they used a lot of pre-Islamic cultural elements to spread the teachings of Islam. So there is a simultaneous localization, and if we want so, Arabization or introduction of some elements of Arabness that are or that can be seen as an intrinsic part of being Muslim, because the Arabic language is the language of the Quran, it's a holy language, it's the language of the prayers. Then there's also the Arabic alphabet that was being used. So Arabic elements of Arabic were in different ways over history integrated into Indonesian culture. And this is also the reason why the use today of the term Arab or Dunia Arab, the Arab world, or Orang Arab, Arab people, is used in such an ambivalent way, that it can be used in an acknowledging manner, that Arab is something that is connected to the birthplace of Islam, the history of Islam, the Prophet Muhammad. There is the concept of the Sunnah, to live in the tradition of the Prophet. So some elements of Arabic culture and customs might be considered as being part of the Sunnah, whereas on the other hand, as I said before, Arab can be used in a denouncing manner. And there is this phenomenon in Indonesia of talking about different forms of Islam. For example, Islam Jawa as Javanese Islam, or Islam Pribumi, the Islam of the indigenous people or the natives. That's something Martin Slamer worked on. And Martin Slamer showed that this concept of Islam Pribumi, for example, that was very popular in the 1980s, was contrasted with a rather gloomy image of Islam Arab. So in this context, Islam Arab and Islam Pribumi, or Islam Arab and Islam Jawa, or also today Islam Nusantara is a new concept, the Islam of the archipelago. So here, Arabness or the attribute Arab is used in a contrasting manner to make a differentiation between the local and the foreign. So it is a cultural differentiation, which says to be Muslim is not to be Arab. But on the other hand, some elements of Arabness are intrinsical part of being Muslim. And this is also politicized between the big leading Muslim umbrella organizations in Indonesia, the Nahdlatul Ulama and Muhammadiyah, some new groups, especially Salafi groups. And I found that here this term is often used within Indonesia to describe something that happens in Indonesia rather than describing something that happens on the Arabian Peninsula.
Right, right. And did you, in your fieldwork, come across conflicts that arose between these sort of different definitions, different understandings of Islam vis-a-vis the Arab world? And if there were any sort of discrepancies or conflicts, how people managed them?
Yeah, so what I described about these contrasting concepts of Islam Arab and Islam Nusantara, this is something that happens very much on the political stage. Whereas I was researching with ordinary people in their everyday life, with labor migrants and pilgrims before they would go or after they returned from the Arabian Peninsula. So I was more interested in the everyday experiences and how of course, these political controversies matter in people's lives. And I did find that in Madura, there was sometimes conflict about this, where Madura is an island that tends to be seen as cut off from Java, that is also economically less developed than Java. But the Madurese people are also very proud of being very pious Muslims and as being very well connected among each other through domestic migration in Indonesia, but also international migration. And in Madura, a lot of people were upset about these rather essentialist classifications of Islam Arab, because they said this cannot be denounced as Arabness. We are living in the tradition of the Prophet Muhammad, and if we dress in a certain way, if we put on the white jubba, it's a white garment from the Arabian Peninsula, this doesn't mean that we ideologically turn towards Islamic traditions from the Arabian Peninsula. It's just our way of living in the tradition of the Prophet. And I realized that in Madura, a lot of people feel misunderstood from other Muslim communities in Indonesia. And this is probably something where there is a little bit of a conflict in this engagement with the Arab world. And also, sometimes among labor migrants, I would realize that, of course, there have been also conflicts within their working contracts. And this is something where some people, some labor migrants are quite successful, and they send home financial remittances, and they help, they are able to support their families. But other labor migrants do make these negative experiences that I talked about before. And in this regard, they would also make this sharp differentiation between religion and culture, and to say we might be united in religion, but culturally we are very distinct from the Arab people. Also when it comes to the way of interpreting Islam or what it means to be Muslim. And some labor migrants would even say, and this is a joke that actually came up quite often in my research, we were always wondering why God sent all his prophets to the Middle East. And now after we've been there, we realize that the people there are so harsh and violent that they needed a prophet to teach them how to behave, whereas the Indonesian people are already soft and refined and kind and polite. So there is probably not an open conflict, but there is this sense of having different approaches to interpreting what it means to be Muslim.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Yes, absolutely. And I suppose in this context, the experience of the labor migrants and the Mecca pilgrims and the conflicts that both of these groups have with the Arab populations in the Middle East, it's fundamentally different. One is sort of spiritually sort of driven, the other one for economic reasons, perhaps. But in chapter two, you focus quite a bit on pilgrimage tourism and the kinds of dilemmas that brings about for Mecca pilgrims, the pilgrim group. And I was wondering if we could sort of talk about that, because you describe how this thing called pilgrimage tourism to Mecca seems to have elicited a wide range of responses from Indonesian pilgrims and locals alike. And I was wondering if you could tell us a bit more about the contested relationship between wealth accumulation, capitalism, morality, and religiosity among Indonesian Muslims, as well as how they understand success in both material and moral terms. How do pilgrims and non-pilgrims alike negotiate local meanings of success and failure in such a highly transnational context? And the tensions that might emerge between, say, wealth accumulation and the sort of capitalistic sort of undercurrents in this thing called pilgrimage tourism and ideas of morality and religiosity.
Yeah. Haven't mentioned so far is that for Mecca, there are two different types of pilgrimages. There is the Hajj, which is one of the five pillars of Islam, which is obligatory and which can only be done during a specific time of the year. And that's why the numbers of participants are also so strictly limited. There is another pilgrimage, that's the Umrah. And the Umrah is technically, some rituals of the Umrah are part of the Hajj, but these rituals can be done at any time or almost any time of the year. And travel agencies probably realize that this is a big market potential, or also people in Indonesia were disappointed that they still have to wait many years until they can do the Hajj because the waiting lists are so long that they were inquiring about possibilities to do this so-called small pilgrimage, the Umrah. So in some regions in Indonesia, the waiting lists are up to 30 years, for example, in Madura, where people are very pious. And of course, thinking that one has to wait 30 years until the departure to the Hajj, it's understandable that some people are afraid that they won't make it to Mecca at all, especially older people. And because of that, there is a boom in Umrah pilgrimages and a general boom in religious tourism in Indonesia. And the difference is that the Hajj would be mainly administered by the government, while the Umrah is the business of private travel agencies. And I talked to a lot of travel agents, and they said that this is really a booming business, and that it is, I mean, this was before the pandemic, of course, that it is increasing every year. And the interesting thing is that a lot of the travel agents found that being a travel agent in a travel agency for religious tourism and enabling people to go to Mecca is a pious deed, that this is also can be considered as a religious act because they support people in traveling to Mecca. So a lot of them were also very pious and practicing Muslims, and they had traveled to Mecca themselves several times often, and they were underlining that this spiritual experience is so extraordinary that they want to make it accessible for more people. So there is, as you said in your question, there is this interrelation of capitalist activities and religious morals, or the idea of piety. This is in other fields in Indonesia, in fashion, for example, we see similar tendencies, what Carla Jones has described as pious consumption. And you mentioned the term success. So I found that it's quite interesting that in this field of this booming pilgrimage business, but quite interestingly also in labor migration, success is a buzzword, that there are ideas of a spiritual success, like a spiritual fulfillment, but also economic success as part of leading a pious life, like a pious or a morally good economic success. And for the Hajj pilgrims, there is also the concept of becoming a Haji Mabrur, which is which literally means that the Hajj is accepted by God, but it can be translated as becoming a virtuous Hajj returnee, where the people who have been to Mecca return as better Muslims, as people who have a morally improved behavior and who become more pious. And then again, these interesting similarities with the labor migrants, where the labor migrants are also expected as being maintaining their moral integrity, especially because of these reports about abuse and exploitation that labor migrant agencies would often preach to the migrant women that they should maintain moral values, that they should stick to politeness and to modesty, to go through this experience and not to get into trouble while being there. Like this idea that abuse and exploitation can happen because of a personal moral failure, where these issues are not seen as a structural problem, but rather as an individualized failure, claiming that if one keeps this piety and morality, then the migration will be successful and there won't be any problems.
Right, right. And so ideas of success and failure, they are sort of crucial, would you say, to these people's experiences of mobility and of worship, really. And would you say that ideas of success and failure are in some ways intertwined in the case of the pilgrims?
Yeah, definitely. I was surprised that I hardly encountered any stories about failure. But it is also in another way that every success story could be the story of a failure of someone else who is, for example, a non-pilgrim. Like when we talk about mobility, it's also to talk about immobility, some people who will not go on the Hajj and who will stay home. So this is not openly described as failure, but on the other hand, the emphasis of success suggests that for other people, there is not this success. So it marks this distinction of Hajj returnees who return with a higher social status and the ones who did not accomplish the Hajj.
Right, right. Yeah. And it is interesting to hear that experiences of failure were a lot less salient in your fieldwork than ideas of success were. That is quite interesting. If you had to shift gear a little bit to move to chapter 3, and we did touch upon this quite a bit at the start of our interview, but in chapter 3, you talk about the heterogeneity of competing Islamic traditions, or different Islamic traditions rather, in Indonesia, and their often ambivalent relationship to ideas of Arabness in the Middle East, as well as within itself. A question that I had was, what you call the Arab other abroad, whether ideas of this Arab other and how it was imagined, did these change as people sort of traveled to the Arab world and came back? Were ideas of Arabness situated locally, did these change as people from Indonesia traveled and then came back? Because in the case of the labor migrants, citizenship isn't sort of permanent residency or citizenship isn't viable, right? So when people return, do local ideas of Arabness change? Yes, that was a question that I had, which I wanted to ask.
Yeah, that's a very interesting question. It's quite interesting to see that, especially in the context of labor migration, in the return context or the home context of labor migrants, there seems to be not so much change. And this is something that also other researchers of labor migration have found, that whereas the experiences of labor migrants are often very intimate and, of course, different from pilgrims who travel in travel units and who go to the holy sites to pray, labor migrants live in private households. They really get to know Arab people. And their experiences are not always negative. Some of them also become friends with their employers, especially the ones who work in care-related work, who care for elderly people or for children. They also develop empathy and affection for the people they care for. And in these cases, the women I talked to, they did have a very fine-grained knowledge of Arab culture and customs, and they would tell me about wedding parties in Arab society and how people there choose their wife and husband and what they see as the differences between Indonesia and the Arab world. So they are in a way also anthropologists, or they are experts on cultural differences. But then again, in their families, they would not talk about it a lot. And several women also told me that they lost their Arabic skills because they don't speak any Arabic anymore once they returned. And they said, finally, someone is asking us about our experiences. A lot of them were quite happy to talk to me, saying that their husbands or their children would not ask so much about their experiences. And I think that's the reason why some images of the Arab world are being reproduced in Indonesia and are not being changed by these nuanced experiences of the labor migrants. So that's something I found quite interesting. I think that it changes for the labor migrants themselves personally, but not on a broader societal level.
That is fascinating. And yeah, that really is intriguing, especially, you know, even if you have to think about in a comparative context for people who are working on, let's say, migrant communities, other migrant communities in the Persian Gulf. And, you know, it'd be very interesting to sort of take your findings, your sort of fieldwork findings, sort of put them in conversation with what others have found across other migrant communities, which would be very interesting.
Maybe I can just add to this that I found from one of my colleagues at the University of Freiburg, Stefan Rota, who works on Filipino migrants, that in the Philippines, labor migrants are organized in bigger labor migrant agencies, and also the protection of human rights has a stronger lobby in the Philippines. And it seems that in the Philippines, there is a stronger sense of abuse and exploitation are structural problems. And of course, there is also many more people from the Philippines who migrate. And whereas in Indonesia, there is this sense of individual failure that I described before. So I think this is a big difference between the Philippines and Indonesia, which probably is also one of the reasons of the different representations of the Arab world or the migration experience back home.
Absolutely. And I think these differences are really, really important because I think sometimes there is this tendency to homogenize the migrant communities that sort of work as quote-unquote labor migrants in the Gulf, but exploring the differences really does bring out a lot of nuance. And if we had to move to the final chapter, which is, it talks a lot about the kinds of guidance that people follow in the symbolic capital of travel experiences. And the question I had was basically, you kind of take us through the many different kinds of local guidance that migrants and pilgrims receive for their journeys to the Gulf. And given that travel to the Arab world is regarded as socially, morally, spiritually meaningful in local Indonesian society, I wanted to ask you, what does the symbolic capital of travel experiences to the Gulf tell us about the kinds of guidance that people choose to follow? And I think this goes back to an earlier discussion that we had about why does guidance matter in mobility? And why are some forms of guidance more preferred than others? And to what extent do individuals get to choose the guidance they follow?
Yeah, so I found during my research that guidance matters very much for people, that in this field of transnational mobility, there is a lot of insecurity. People have the longing to go to Mecca, for example, but it seems like such a complicated undertaking. All the bureaucratic procedures, even making a passport, signing up, putting one's name on a mail on a waiting list, paying the fees for the pilgrimage, interacting with these government agencies. So for many people whom I met, it seemed like it is very complicated to do this. And same goes for labor migration, where in addition to all these bureaucratic procedures, there is also the insecurity of going alone abroad and working in a family. So I found that among both migrants and pilgrims, there is a demand for guidance. Guidance is something they are looking for. And when I talk about guidance, I mean various forms of guidance, like the institutional guidance through government departments or private agencies, but also the personal guidance through people who have done a pilgrimage or who have migrated before, and also the more general guidance through guiding narratives, guiding representations, recurring images and ideas. And I found that this sense of insecurity creates a strong demand for guidance, and people turn to guiding actors and institutions. And then on the side of these guiding actors and institutions, guidance turns out to be profitable. Offering guidance, for example, for travel agencies can be a profitable business, but also on a much smaller scale for personal private intermediaries. For example, someone who introduces a friend to the idea of doing an Umrah pilgrimage, that people are together in a Quran reading group and they talk about this idea of going to Mecca, and it's like taking someone on the hand and one person knows a bit more than the other. And sometimes it's very blurry if someone is a friend or an intermediary, and where intermediaries also become business men and women. Sometimes travel agencies would give people who bring another person along a certain discount, for example. And then people are being included in this business, and also in labor migration. I, for example, in one village, an older woman told me that she never wanted to be an agent in labor migration, but that she was a teacher in a local school, and some women who had graduated from the school, they didn't really find work and they didn't see good perspectives in the village. And they were asking her if she knows anything of possibilities for labor migration. And then she was asking around in her family. And then there was actually someone who went on labor migration. Then she connected people. Then later the same people asked her if she has a bank account and if they could use her bank account to transfer remittances, because they didn't have a bank account. And slowly she became this labor migrant agent, which, as she said, was not her intention. But in the end, she became, and then people would also give her, would acknowledge her services through financial gifts. So it's not always a clear fee, or it's not always a specific percentage of to what extent intermediaries profit from giving guidance. It's an interrelated process of people who demand guidance and others who give guidance. And in some cases, this is more institutionalized, and in others, it can be really informal. And in terms of capital, I mean, there is this financial capital. There is also the social capital of networks and connections between people, and the symbolic capital, the symbolic capital of having accomplished the Hajj. And by the way, also a lot of labor migrants do accomplish the Hajj, even though their mobility is labeled as labor migration. A lot of them, while they are working on the Arabian Peninsula, they do accomplish the Hajj. And what I found striking is that not everyone has the same access to this symbolic capital of the Hajj, even though labor migrants might have done the Hajj, because they didn't do it through the official government channels, and they didn't do it with an Indonesian travel unit, and they didn't have a return celebration when they came back, because they did it while they were living and working there. It's not the same effect in society. And it made me realize that there is not only the guidance to enable the physical mobility, but there is also the guidance to enable social mobility or sociocultural recognition.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think this also goes back to something you had brought up earlier, where these agents, or I don't know if you can even think of them as sort of brokers, or religious brokers mm-hmm. of some kind, yeah. How these people sort of believe themselves to become pious as they help people make these journeys, whether it's the Umrah or the longer Hajj. And yeah, it is the interplay between sort of mediating these journeys and sort of becoming pious by helping others is really, really fascinating. It's something that I hadn't really considered until your book. So thank you for that. And we're slowly approaching the end of our interview. But before we end, there are just two final questions I'd like to ask you. The first one is, what do you hope scholars working on Indian Ocean mobilities, very broadly, what do you hope we'd be able to take from your book? And what new directions of research is your work pointing us to? If you could just say a couple of words about that.
Yeah, I think with this whole topic of mobility, there have been different approaches of studying mobility. And in recent years, there has been also an emphasis on fixity and on immobility, or on bounded mobility and control. And a lot of scholars have recognized that mobility is not by far not always free floating, but on the contrary, it's often strictly controlled and not accessible for everyone. But what I found in this example of labor migration and pilgrimage in Indonesia and the overall engagement with the Arab world is that there is something in between free-floating mobility and control or fixity or immobility. And this is what I describe as guided mobility, that there are forms of mobility where there is this interdependent relationship between the ones who enable and also control mobility on the one hand, and on the other hand, those who become mobile. And I think it's very fruitful to look at this interdependency, and also at forms of mixed migration, where, for instance, some pilgrims would use a visa for the minor pilgrimage for the Umrah, but then they would stay in Saudi Arabia and work while waiting for the Hajj season. And that way they can do the Hajj even though they did not register for the official annual quota and they did not put their name on the waiting list. So these are forms of migration that we can only see when we create an awareness for mixed migration, and maybe where also forms of mobility go back to historical forms of mobility, where there was this mixture of studying, working, and doing the Hajj in the Hijaz. So I think this is something that I want to suggest with the book, that with this concept of guided mobility, we can look at the in-between places of mixed migration and categories of being a broker, but at the same time also being a migrant, to create more fluid categories.
Absolutely. And those are very, very productive and helpful suggestions that would, I think, certainly take the study of the Indian Ocean world and, you know, the incredible work that's already coming out from this field, I think it would really, you know, enhance what's already going on. And finally, would you mind telling us a little bit about any projects that you might be working on currently, or any future projects that are in the works?
Yeah, sure. I'd be happy to. I'm now speaking from Jerusalem. So after my journeys between Indonesia and Germany, and my work, which methodologically focused on returnees from labor migration and pilgrimage, I now find myself in the Middle East. And I realized during that research for the book that in this booming pilgrimage business, there is also a lot of Christian travels, not only Muslim religious tourism, but also Christian religious tourism, where for many Christian Indonesians, a journey to Jerusalem is almost like an equivalent of their Muslim compatriots' Hajj. So this was something I found fascinating, and I thought I have to look into this. And I was lucky enough to meet Roni Drici at the Hebrew University of Jerusalem and started a postdoc with her. And this gave me the opportunity to research Indonesian religious tourism to Jerusalem in Jerusalem. So not as before to research with returnees, but to actually be here during the travels. And then I also realized that there is, of course, the majority are Christian groups, but now there are also more and more Muslim groups who do the Al-Aqsa pilgrimage to Al-Aqsa Mosque in Jerusalem. And it's like a package, pilgrimage package tour that usually starts in Cairo, then goes to Israel and Palestine and ends in Jordan. And yeah, that's what I'm working on, or what I was working on until the beginning of the pandemic. I accompanied a lot of Indonesian Muslim and Christian travel groups on their journey. And I also tried to understand what this means for the common Indonesian national identity, as feeling united as Indonesian national citizens, but then also on the Muslim-Christian relations. What does it mean to share a travel destination as a shared interreligious travel destination, but to be in different travel groups? That's one of the topics in this new project. And also now during the pandemic, the use of social media and new technologies, pilgrimages on Zoom, that's some of the topics I work on right now.
That is absolutely fascinating. And I cannot wait to read some of the work that comes out of this new project, especially the whole Muslim-Christian relations thing and sharing of religious destinations. That is fascinating. But thank you. Thank you so much, Miriam, for joining me here today and for taking the time to speak with me and talk more about your work. I absolutely enjoyed it.
My pleasure. Thank you very much for your encouraging and very interesting and vivid questions.
No, my absolute pleasure. Thanks, Miriam.